It's really lovely to be here. Thank you to the royal family. Thank you, members of the royal family. Thank you for having me. There are few things more inspiring for me than meeting a brilliant woman doing brilliant work. The mayor of Amsterdam, really, it's a highlight for me meeting you. And thank you for your cleverness and your charm. And and it's also just really lovely to be with people who are brilliant thinkers. I've really enjoyed listening to my fellow speakers. And Francine, like you, I like ceilings. So I'm fascinated by your ceilings. And I want to say thank you to you, Professor Israel, for your fascinating history of Amsterdam. As I listened to you, I imagined 17th century Amsterdam alive with so many stories. And it brought to mind an abiding memory from my childhood. I was sitting in the back seat of my mother's car as she drove us past the market. And I looked out of the window at the bustle of people and cars and shoppers and hawkers, and I felt a pang of melancholy, because what I saw were stories, so many stories, and I knew that I would never be able to tell them all. Cities are stories waiting to be told. In the oldest surviving work of written literature, the Epic of Gilgamesh, which dates to about 2100 BC, the city is an important motif. A woman, Shamat, tells her lover, who lives in the wild, about her home in the city of Uruk. And as she tells him of the dances and the festivals and the food in her city, he's utterly captivated. Perhaps it isn't surprising that the oldest surviving work of literature is set in a city. I believe that the natural human instinct is to community. Doctors tell us today that to live healthy lives, we need sleep, which I haven't had much of lately, nutrition, exercise, and community. Of course, community can be achieved outside of cities, but there is an undeniable, palpable energy, a vitality, a force when different human beings are brought together, when human beings are together. It is sublime, almost magical in its potential power, in what can happen. Even if the exchange of ideas is not the intention, humans will invariably exchange ideas. They will mingle and mix and meet because they're human. My social studies teacher in secondary school would often say in a booming voice, "Man is not an island." Hopefully he felt the same way about woman. In saying that, he wanted always to remind his students of the intrinsic human need for community, that we are not made to be solitary beings. And the most remarkable example of this intrinsic human need is the city. I think of an ideal city as a paean to the possibilities of human coexistence, to complexity, always gray, never white and black, both natural and man-made, a repository of nuance. A city is proof of the human ability to dream, the human imagination. How should we live? How should we play and shop and learn and eat? The city is a symbol of hope and unity, but even more importantly, it is a symbol of the hope for unity. In a city, we walk past each other on the street and we sit in a restaurant or a bus or a train where someone else has just been, and we touch the same things, and never mind the germs we exchange. And there is a closeness there, and a stranger becomes familiar simply by her presence, and a neighbor becomes a friend, and suddenly the unfamiliar becomes ordinary, becomes normal. And there is no better sign of belonging than to feel normal and ordinary. This is not, of course, to suggest some romanticized idea of human togetherness. When Professor Israel spoke of the Amsterdam of Rembrandt and Spinoza, where one could walk down any street and see people of vastly different religions, I was struck by his rather wonderful characterization of Mennonites as being in several internally feuding varieties. There is no doubt that the other religions were also in externally feuding varieties, as it should be. Conflict will invariably occur when different human beings are gathered because they're human. It is not the absence of discord that characterizes the ideal city, but the shared idea of the residents of the city. That people will fight and quarrel and disagree, but it does not occur to any of them to question the belonging of others. A city is about the idea of belonging, about longing and belonging. The ideal city becomes a place where the theme song is made up of the words, "I am here and you are here." In Shakespeare's play, Coriolanus, Sisenius is a key character. He's a tribune. He's a representative of the common people. And his famous line from that play is, "What is the city but the people?" As a fiction writer, everything for me is potential material. Every experience or observation could become the raw clay from which characters and narrative are molded. When I was a child, I was known for eavesdropping, an activity at which I'm still quite adept. Only much later did I realize that yes, I was a nosy child, but I was also a budding storyteller, and to eavesdrop was merely to employ a tool for finding material. There is no place better for watching people and for eavesdropping on strangers' conversations than a city. I have not had much luck in Amsterdam on this trip, but I did have some luck in past trips on eavesdropping, in cafes in particular. It is the breathing human architecture of cities that best feeds the hunger to create stories. And so what indeed is the city but its people? And yet, in most stories of the city, there is a dark undertone, even if sometimes just a hint. The shadow of the myth of Babylon seems to run through narratives about cities, which is that the city, despite its many charms, can destroy you. Lagos is Nigeria's great city, its commercial center, its beating heart. Lagos has 10% of the population, but it accounts for 60% of Nigeria's commercial activities. When I was growing up on a quiet university campus, the stories I heard of the city of Lagos were certainly Babylonian. "Beware of Lagos" was a standard trope of those stories. Beware of the dangerous and dirty city with its insolence, its materialism, its endless, reckless hustle, a place which could poison your soul. The end result of those stories I heard as a child is that as an adult, I now have a home in Lagos. On Sundays when the roads are not clogged up with traffic, I like to be driven around Lagos, headed nowhere, just watching the city, past bus stops full of people with earphones stuck in their ears, a roadside market with colorful bras swinging from a balcony, wheelbarrows filled with carrots, a table laid out with wigs, fat, glorious watermelons piled high, hawkers selling onions, eggs, bread, the secondhand books spread on low tables with curled covers. Lagos is full of notices and signs. The most common: "This house is not for sale," which is often scrawled on walls, a warning to those who might be duped by people who attempt to sell houses they do not own. From a bridge, I look across at shirtless men fishing on flimsy canoes, and I think often of how quickly fights and friendships are formed in Lagos in a way that would never happen in a non-urban space in Nigeria. A bus has hit another, and both conductors leap out for a swift fight. People make friends while in queue at the banks, bus stops, and they unite over obvious jokes and shared complaints. And when I stop to buy a snack from a hawker on the street, I look at the gutters clogged with sludgy green water and cans and plastic bags, and I imagine the possibility of a clean city. But what does it mean for a city to be clean? I don't mean necessarily tidy or orderly. I think an excess of orderliness is in fact anti-urban. It is the unexpected, the messy, that can entrance. Much like writing fiction, the ideal city is organic, its loose ends never too neatly tied, and it is so filled with possibility that you imagine the characters' lives ongoing long after you have closed the last page. And yet, somehow, it makes a cohesive, imperfect whole. And it is perhaps this multifaceted idea of the city that has made it a refuge for so many over the course of human history. I'd like to read a short poem published in 1922 and written by the African-American poet Claude McKay, who was born in Jamaica in 1889. For one brief golden moment, rare like wine, the gracious city swept across the line, oblivious of the color of my skin, forgetting that I was an alien guest. She bent to me, my hostile heart to win, caught me in passion to her pillowy breast, the great proud city seized with a strange love. For many African Americans fleeing the small southern towns of their birth during the Great Migration, cities like Chicago and New York were an escape precisely because they were urban and therefore not beholden to entrenched provincial prejudices. They were free of the kind of perverse intimacy of the racism of small towns. And it's not that cities were free of prejudice, but that they, in their urban diversity, had more spaces for solace and for resistance. And much like those who were fleeing internal oppression, for many immigrants who come from different parts of the world and move to a new and unfamiliar place, the city is less daunting, because in a place familiar with strangeness, you can never be too strange. And so the promise of the ideal city is you will find your kin, you will find your urban tribe. When I was first building a house in Lagos, I told a European acquaintance, a diplomat in Lagos, about it. And he asked where the house was, and I said it was in the new part of Lagos, which is mostly reclaimed land. I thought perhaps that he might ask to see pictures or maybe just say, oh, that's nice. But he said, your house will be underwater in 30 years. I knew he was not very happy to have been posted to Lagos, a hardship posting. He spoke of Lagosians with the resentment of a person who dislikes the popular kids in the playground but still wants to be their friend. By the way, he was not Dutch. He was German. I bet that makes you happy. But I am happy to say that I have since met many other German diplomats who were lacking in this particular brand of sourness. But the truth is that I have shared his apocalyptic vision of Lagos. He was reacting to something unheeding in Lagos's development, something utterly reckless. So forward-looking is Lagos, headlong, rushing, dissatisfied in its own frenzy, that in its haste, it might very well sacrifice long-term planning or the possibility of permanence, or even the faith of its citizens. One wonders always in Lagos, have things been done properly? And I really cannot stop imagining the ocean one day retaking its own. That must be a scary thought for a country that is underneath sea level. Fortunately, my house is not underwater yet. But the ideal city must contend with this apocalyptic vision, must have a measure of circumspection about a future that we rush into, and must have, as its foundation, the respect for nature. By 2050, 2/3 of human beings in the world will live in cities. In his book about the history of the city, Metropolis, Ben Wilson writes that many people assumed that with the growth and spread of the internet, we would no longer need cities. We could live in isolated communities and get on video calls. Who needs urban networks when you could have virtual networks? But this did not happen. As he writes, humans thrive when they share knowledge, collaborate, and compete in face-to-face settings, and in particular, in places that facilitate information flows. And so, while the idea of the mad genius locked away in a tower thinking up some new innovation has its romantic appeal, much of the innovations that have driven human history have come from the interaction of people close together in cities. Until the year 1800, about 4% of the human population lived in urban areas, and yet that 4% had a largely disproportionate impact on the affairs of the world. It is the work done in cities, the ingenuity nurtured in cities, that has driven history as we know it. And so it appears that for human progress, we need cities. We need Amsterdam. We need Amsterdams. But what should cities be? Cities should be, above all else, places where people are given room and places of many stories. I want to tell you a small story about my family. In 1967, almost 60 years ago now, my parents lived on the campus of the University of Nigeria in a small town called Nsukka. My father was a professor, my mother was an administrator, and in 1967, they had two small children, a yard full of flowers, a stable and happy life. Then the Nigeria-Biafra War started. They thought it was far away, that it would be resolved quickly, that their lives would not change in any dramatic way. But only days later, my parents heard the sound of shelling and gunfire, so frightening, so close to the university gates, that they had very little time to pack anything before they piled their children into the car and fled. They left almost all their belongings behind. They ended up in another town, a town already very crowded. They could not find a place to stay. The refugee camps were full. My father was desperate. He was worried about being out in the open because of the air raids. He knew a man who was from that town, a man named Emmanuel Ezike, a former colleague at the university. Emmanuel lived in a cramped house that was full of people, members of his extended family, people whose homes the war had also snatched. My father also knew that it would be very difficult for Emmanuel to accommodate them, very difficult to stretch what was already badly stretched. Still, my father knocked on Emmanuel's door. Emmanuel looked at my parents holding on to their two small, scared daughters, their faces shadowed in despair, And he said, "We will make room for you." Then he showed them the bunker, a hole in the ground, to which they all ran as soon as they heard the wail of air raid alarms. Emmanuel didn't just welcome them, he made them feel included as much as he could. I heard this story many, many times from my father, told and retold, and I think of that moment as central to my family's history because I wonder if my parents would have survived the war had they not benefited from that act of immense kindness. For 3 years, my parents were refugees, and they owed a lot not only to Emmanuel, but also to many humanitarian workers, those women and men magnificent in their bravery and their commitment. But my parents were not just refugees. Nobody is ever just a refugee. Nobody is ever just a single thing. And yet, in the public discourse today, we often speak of people as a single thing, refugee, immigrant. We dehumanize people when we reduce them to a single thing. And I say this as a person who is guilty of this kind of insidious and often unconscious dehumanization, and a person who tries now every day to remember that people are never a single thing. I learned a powerful lesson about the impact that stories can have when I first went to Mexico as a college student in the US. It was my first time in Mexico. And at the time, just as now, the political climate in the US was tense, and there were debates going on about immigration, and immigration was often synonymous with Mexicans. And Mexicans were all portrayed through a singular lens of negativity. Stories of Mexicans being arrested at the border, Mexicans stealing, Mexicans fleecing the healthcare system, Mexicans bringing disease. I remember walking around on my first day in Guadalajara, a beautiful city, watching people who were going to work and school, people who were laughing, people who were buying and selling and smoking. At first, I felt surprised at all the people I saw and the diversity of their actions. And then I was overwhelmed with shame. I realized that I had been so immersed in the American media's narrow coverage of Mexicans that I saw Mexicans as only one thing, undocumented immigrant. And I had forgotten their humanity, and I could not have been more ashamed of myself. In my language, Igbo, the word for love is ifunanya, and its literal translation is to see another person with your eyes, to truly see. We cannot measure our humanity, but we can act on it. Our humanity is that glowing center in all of us, or perhaps in most of us. It is what makes us speak up about an injustice, even when that injustice does not personally affect us. It is what makes us aware that we are better off if our fellow human beings are better off. It is what reminds us that we are not just bones and flesh, that we are emotional beings who all share a desire to be valued, a desire to matter, to be seen. It is what makes us realize that dignity is as important as food. And it is what made Emmanuel, in his cramped home full of relatives, still open his door to my parents. And so I think of my ideal city as a place of making room. Human history is a story of human movement. Cities embody human history because they're products of human movement. I am endlessly fascinated, for example, by how many dream seekers move every year to my home city of Lagos. Lagos is expected to become, in the next 10 years, one of the world's megacities, a term that conceals in its almost triumphant preface the chaos of overpopulation. Nigeria is Africa's most populous country. One in five Africans is Nigerian. And so people come to Lagos from other parts of Nigeria, from other West African countries, from other African countries, they come. Skilled workers coming from countries as far away as South Africa, less skilled workers come from the countries that share a border with Nigeria. My gate man, Abdul, who has worked with me for 10 years, is a young Muslim man from Niger Republic, Nigeria's northern neighbor. He often tells the story of how, in his small ancestral village in Niger, Lagos was seen as the city of shining light, and he longed to leave and find work in Lagos, to live in Lagos and return twice a year with the sparkle of Lagos on his skin. When I listen to Abdul talk about how happy he is to be living his dream, I think of cities as repositories of dreams. But to say that cities should be places that make room is not just about physical room, although that, of course, is important, such as affordable housing, public spaces, as the mayor of Paris talked about, and also what Francine wonderfully refers to as people's palaces. But making emotional room is equally important. Room in the stories that are told, in how they're told. I am, of course, biased because I'm a writer and literature is the love of my life, but I know from my life as a reader, not just a writer, that stories can profoundly change the way we think about people. In Lagos, people have turned many things into art forms, and one of those things is complaining. A gathering of Lagosians anywhere, and invariably the conversation becomes a litany of complaints, as it should be, really. We complain about corruption, disorder, traffic, electricity, and for the younger ones, they complain about the dating scene. There is even a recently published collection of stories in Lagos called Nearly All the Men in Lagos Are Mad. I once asked a young woman after she had complained about Lagos, why do you choose to live in Lagos then? Every time I ask this of a young person dissatisfied with Lagos, they look puzzled to be asked, as though they assumed it to be obvious that they would never consider leaving. Everybody complains about Lagos, but nobody wants to leave. And yet, I've always found it curious that when a foreigner says exactly the same things Nigerians say to one another about Lagos, corruption, disorder, Nigerians get very upset. I'm one of those, by the way. And I've come to realize that this is because Nigerians know that other Nigerians know that these complaints are not our only stories, that we also have stories of ingenuity and drive and potential. And they fear that the foreigner does not know and will therefore take the negative as our only story. Stories matter in cities. Stories matter in cities, especially for those not at the center. Fuller stories, stories that start not with ideology, but simply with truth and humanity. Stories of people in need cannot be only about their need. They must also be about what they love, what they resent, what wounds their pride, what they aspire to, what makes them laugh. Because otherwise it will be impossible to understand them. And policy that is created without understanding people will never work. Today, the language increasingly used about migrants in the US and in Europe is horrendous, the language of criminality. And in using that language, we forget that the history of humanity on Earth is a history of movement. Last September, the American vice president made the false claim that Haitian immigrants were eating their neighbors' pets, cats and dogs. He later claimed that, yes, it might not be true, but that kind of story was necessary so that the media would pay attention to the suffering of the American people, which is incomprehensible. It is not clear how spreading lies makes people pay attention to the suffering of the American people, nor is it clear what suffering he means. But it is clear that in those words were a casual contempt for the dignity of his fellow Americans, and that he was practicing that depraved trick of scapegoating, looking for who to blame. But for many Americans, his words about Haitians might be the only story they will hear about Haitians. And the stories we hear of people shapes how we see them and how we think about them. And so there is a responsibility that comes with telling stories. How many stories do we know of ordinary life in the city of Gaza? And to think of Professor Israel's words about the Dutch Golden Age. Sorry, I keep talking about you, but it was very interesting. And I found it really interesting to think about the idea of the Dutch Golden Age and how we should talk, and should it even be called a Golden Age? And intellectually, I understand that at the time, the morality was different. Churches decided what was morally relevant, and churches supported slavery. But it is also impossible for me to think of this Golden Age in these clinical terms alone, because I think also of my ancestors and of their enslavement and of the labor and toil from which they never benefited. We need multiple stories. When we read stories, we become alive in bodies that are not our own. It is not so much that you become someone else, but in an act of radical imagination, you see the world as they see it, even if briefly. For me, storytelling is often about that expression, what if? An expression I love, an expression that often underpins my writing, what if? If I'm told it can't be, my response is, what if it can? It's about possibility, about dreaming, about trying. In this way, I think literature is similar to the city. Cities prove that we are never a single thing in their ability to create layered identities. Or as a friend of mine recently said, I'm from Minnesota, but I'm a New Yorker. I've always believed that most conditions in the world could be better, that we can create a world that is much better than what we have, that is more equal, more just. And this belief may be naive, and I think perhaps we should embrace a considered naivety from time to time. But I think we sometimes disagree because we haven't actually heard one another and we haven't actually seen one another. We know that changing laws and policies and having best practices are all important for creating change. But I think that cultural change should be given primacy, not because it is more important than economics and law and politics, but because it is the most complex, the most layered, the most difficult to change, the most successful when you do change it. And cultural change happens with human creativity, with storytelling. In thinking of how urbanized we have become as a human race, I like to think of such quirky examples as that house finches, birds, in Arizona, are now evolving longer beaks because they now eat from guarding bird feeders. But mostly, in thinking of how urbanized we've become, I think about visitors to outer space, who speak of looking down to see the scattering of light over the surface of the earth at nighttime. And I would like to quote a small section from a poem called August Morning, Upper Broadway. And it's by an American poet, Alicia Ostriker. She was born in Brooklyn in 1937. Let us call this scene a window looking out, not at a paradise, but as a paradise might be if we had eyes to see. I'm not courageous enough to travel to space, but to think of that scattering of light on Earth at nighttime is to think of something almost transcendental and humbling, and to be reminded that there is so much we do not know of our own existence, and yet, here, in this scattering of light, we can be beside one another, muddling along, imperfect, trying, striving together. Thank you.